and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Welcome to another episode of Lunching with Lawyers. Today I'm in beautiful Auchenflower at the home of Noel Noonan. Noel is a recently retired magistrate after serving for 27 years. In his early years as a magistrate, he was based in Mount Isa and Cairns, and after that mainly in southeast of Queensland in Brisbane. Welcome, Noel, to Lunching with Lawyers.
Thank you, Laura.
I know that you recently retired from the bench. Were you happy to do that, or did you want to stay?
Well, for the last 5 years, I've been part-time, which was great. It was a way of easing out. So I was quite happy to retire at the mandatory minimum age of 70. So that worked out quite well. I'm really glad. I wouldn't have stayed that long unless I was able to work part-time, because it's a very demanding job. You've got to be in court every day. You're often dealing with long lists, and there's pressure on you with reserved decisions. If you hear a case, you could have two QCs before you and constitutional arguments. And then if you reserve that decision, you've got to wait for a transcript, then go back to it. It's difficult getting days out of court to work on reserved decisions, other than maybe one day every now and then. You've got to go and ask for it, beg for it virtually. So it is a difficult job, and I'm sure I would have retired earlier if I didn't have that part-time option.
All right, but if there hadn't been that mandatory age requirement, would you have kept going?
I'm not sure. Really, I've applied to be an acting magistrate. That's the first job I've applied for 27 years. Well, so that enables you to come back and do relieving work.
Yeah. Well, I wish you luck in that. I'm sure you've got a few good references. Maybe from some of the people that have appeared before you. You may have liked Brisbane because you spent the majority of your career there, but could it really beat the heady days of sitting as the coroner in Cairns on the Lonergan case?
Yeah, well, that was a big case in my early years, because I'd been in Brisbane for about a year and then I was transferred to Cairns. And that itself was interesting, because at the time, a magistrate had been transferred to Rockhampton, but he was appealing that decision. It was the first appeal ever against the decision of the chief magistrate to uproot him from his home in Cairns and transfer him to Rockhampton. And that appeal was being heard. So when I left Brisbane, I was under instructions that if he won the appeal, I was to turn right and go to Rockhampton. If he lost the appeal, I was to keep going to Cairns. And, so one of the first matters I got up there was that coroner's inquest, because in those days the coroners weren't specialists. Every magistrate was a coroner, and it was just part of the general duties. The incident of the Lonergans is quite well known. It was very controversial. There was a lot of international media coverage. They went diving up on the Barrier Reef, St. Crispin's Reef, in 1998. And they had three dives that day, and it was the weekend crew on the dive tour. and they got left behind, and all their gear was left on the boat, but it wasn't picked up for 2 days when someone from their accommodation started ringing and saying, well, do you know where they are? And then they realised that their gear, was personal gear, was still left on the boat, and then they looked at the log, so divers were expected to sign a log on return, and their names were missing.
Well, that what was it like, though, to have all that media attention directed towards you as the coroner in that case?
Well, I did a view, which I was used to because I did planning and environment court work as a barrister, and that, but they were rare in those days where you would actually go out and have a look at the scene. And I made the mistake of wearing a Hawaiian shirt going out, and I got photographed, and I was on the front page of the Courier Mail in my Speedos too as well. So it looked to everyone, the powers that be in the magistrate's court, that I was having a good time out at the reef. But it was incredibly valuable to go out there. They wouldn't let us dive at the site. I had my diving certification by then. But they allowed us to snorkel over the site, and it was, there were a couple of pontoons long way in the distance, and the suggestion was they could have swam. There was also the suggestion that they'd faked their own disappearance and that it was a murder-suicide. The dive industry in Cairns didn't react very well. They were very defensive, as there were a litany of negligent mistakes made by the people on that boat that were supposed to be taking them. The Lonigans, it turned out, were very good divers who liked to stay underwater as long as possible. And this was an unusual dive because it offered 3 dives in the one day out of Port Douglas. Most of them only offered 2 dives. So they were attracted to that. And unfortunately, they got left behind, and there was all sorts, as I said, of speculation as to what had happened to him, and some unfortunate things were said in his diary. But after a week of an inquest, which happened quite quickly, really, it was in September, after the had disappeared in January, went for a week, and then I gave the decision about a week later. And found that they'd probably been taken by a shark or drowned, a tiger shark, and that they hadn't faked their own disappearance. It was just a ridiculous theory. And you know, they hadn't accessed any of their money, for instance, or bank accounts or insurance policies. And they were a happy, young, loving couple. So the idea of murder-suicide was also ridiculous. So, but that was controversial at the time, and then I charged the manager of the company and the he was the captain on the boat on that day with manslaughter, which you could do in those days. And he went to trial, and it had eventually had an 11-day trial in before the Supreme Court in Cairns, and was acquitted. I think juries are reluctant to find someone guilty of manslaughter when what it really means is criminal negligence causing death. But local juries tend to be sympathetic to defendants in those sort of cases, because they often see it as a civil issue, negligence.
Well, I think also because they could see themselves doing something, you know, that might be really terrible in hindsight, but they think, I can see myself in that situation.
Yes.
And the media attention, except for the speedo. Have you still got the pictures of the speedos?
Yeah, I have, yeah. Well, it wasn't just me. It was counsel assisting and a defence lawyer. But
they were all in speedos too.
I had a rashie on as well. So. But, yeah. But one interesting thing arising out of that was that in those days, witnesses could claim privilege against self-incrimination. Mm. So often your key witnesses would hop in the witness box and not give any evidence. They just claim privilege because it may incriminate them. It's a wide privilege and may incriminate. So like all the people on the boat, including the dive captain and the staff, didn't give evidence. They just claimed privilege. So I recommended to the Attorney General at the time, Matt Foley, that the law be changed so that they had to answer questions, they had to give evidence, but that evidence couldn't be used against them in criminal proceedings. And that was implemented that amendment was made to the Act. So I take credit for changing the practice of the coroner's court.
Well, that's not a bad legacy.
Yeah, like how are you expected to find out what went wrong and to make recommendations to improve the system when the key witnesses don't have to give evidence?
So were there improvements made to the system, like particularly in the dive industry, their processes and procedures as a result of that inquest?
Yes, there were all sorts of improvements made. I think the dive industry, it's a big employer, not during COVID times, but in normal international visitor times in Cairns, it's a big employer of people. A lot of people go to Cairns to do they get their dive certificate. It is a big industry, and there's regularly people dying from even snorkeling deaths up on the reef.
I'm glad I didn't go snorkeling when I was up there recently for that reason. All right, I'm going to take you back to young Noel, yes. the famous Noel of the Lonergan era. I know you went to school at Nudgee College, which is in Brisbane. Mm-hmm. That's quite a prestigious school now. Was it like that back in the 1960s?
In some respects it was, I suppose. There were a lot of kids from the country there, so a lot of kids from working properties. It wasn't a particularly strong academic school at the time, although it produced lots of judges and people who have achieved well academically.
And was that because your parents were reasonably well off that they send you to Nudgee instead of the local high school?
The story is my father was a grader driver, then he did very a milkman and ended up being a publican. But his father had also been a grader driver, and his father had built the second oval. Nudgee's famous for its rugby league, rugby union rather. He built the second oval, and he said to his sons, if I had the money, I would have sent you to this school. So, of course, one of my father's goals was to send his eldest son to Nudgee College. Yeah.
Oh, that's a lovely story. I wonder if you got a discount on the fees because of grandfather being the builder of the oval.
No, I'm sure he didn't. He was a hard-working publican. But the problem was I was sent there too young. I was sent there in grade 8 when I was 12, and I'd come from a big, loving family and sent to this boarding school with some kids that had been at Nudgee Junior. Quite a lot of them had been at Nudgee, and some of them were quite sadistic. And I was very lonely and homesick.
And so where was your family from then?
At that stage, they had a hotel in Boona.
Oh, yeah, so it was out in the sticks. Would have been really out in the sticks in those days.
Yeah, so you'd only go home a few times a year at the end of term. My parents would come down and visit every now and then. But I remember taking, the first time I went home, I took two kids from Papua New Guinea who didn't have any family and would have had to spend the holidays in the college, at the college. So I took them with me home to Boona.
That would have been a great experience at a pub in Boona for the school holidays.
Yeah, it was good.
They would have come back. Well, see, when I was looking at the your early years and particularly where you went to school, I did wonder, going to a school like that, how you ended up in community legal centres. And having such a social justice background, but it's starting to make more sense. But I will ask you about that later on. So what made you pursue a law degree then?
Well, I was going to be a doctor because I'd done quite well academically. I was always in the top four in out of, 100 students or so. And they sort of pointed you towards the medical profession. And but then I lost interest in science during grade 12, so I thought, oh, well, I'll do a law degree. I'll do an arts degree and I'll just back it up with a law degree to provide a source of earning an income, I suppose, if I wanted to take it up. And even when I graduated at the end, it was still a choice between going into the Commonwealth Public Service or doing articles. And fortunately, I chose articles because as soon as I got involved in the law, I knew I liked it. They're just doing conveyances for people, or they're working on wills and estates or mortgages. I found I really enjoyed it.
I wouldn't have thought working on conveyancing or wills and estates was a draw card for practicing law.
Well, like a conveyance is, it's a discrete period of time. So you meet people, you help them out with the purchase of their home, often the biggest thing financially in their life. And at the end of 4 or 6 weeks, it's all over and they're happy. And
hopefully they're happy. That's the sale fell through. Where did you went to UQ, didn't you?
Yes.
Why did you choose that law school to go to?
That was the only one around at the time, really. There was QUT. It was QIT. It was an institute then. The only law degree was. But you do the arts part first. And initially I wasn't that interested in the law, and I just managed to scrape through my law subjects. After a while, I was trying to change the world. I was a student activist.
Well, I was going to ask you about your activism in the university. Did you get arrested, Noel?
I did get arrested.
For what?
It was a freedom of speech issue in the mall, and I was arrested with Drew Hutton. But I'd just come out of a seminar at Legal Aid, actually, which was in MacArthur Chambers there at the time. And that's where I'd done my articles, in that building, in the corner of Edward and Queen, with Macrossan and Byrne. But on that day, I'd come out of this seminar, and they were having this freedom of speech rally. And I was just there, and I was approached by the police.
Hang on, I can see this, and the magistrate's going, and you were just there. I'm sure that you've said that to a few defendants over the time.
I suppose I was participating, and I was just listening to the speeches, and these police officers come up and asked me to move on. And I asked the police officer, because they're in plain clothes, I said, well, how do I know you're a police officer? He arrested me. So I was outraged at the time. But I was thrown in a paddy wagon with Drew Hutton, who you might know was the leader of the Queensland Greens for a long time, and taken down to the watch house. But then we were granted cash bail of $70. So if you came up with $70, they'd let you out. And I was going to fight it and take it to the High Court. And I remember consulting John Gerrard, who went on to be a QC on the Court of Appeal. I consulted him about it, and we were going to fight it. But after a while, the fight goes out of you, and it's just easier to forfeit the cash bail.
Isn't it funny, because that's the advice that we give our client. Well, I gave to my clients a lot of the times, is that they always say to me, I want to fight this, Loretta, on the principle. Yeah. The principle is important. And I go, the principle is going to drag out for a very long time and cost you a lot of money. I'd be paying the money, whatever it is. Yeah. Was that an impediment then to getting admitted, having been arrested?
No. There was no conviction. You just forfeit bail. So I presume it's on some police record somewhere, but it was never ever an impediment to me.
All right. Well, That's interesting because, you know, a lot of people did as much as they could as law students not to be arrested for that reason. So you became, though, principal solicitor and coordinator at the Student Legal Services at QUT in 1976. That would have just been after you were admitted, or had you done your articles at that stage?
Well, it was at University of Queensland, so the Students Legal Service. I was the first employed solicitor there. And, yeah, I'd done 2 years articles by that stage. And I was admitted and I worked there for a year till I went overseas for a year in 1977. And then when I came back, I was employed as their principal solicitor again. And to have insurance and a trust account, I set up NF Noonan & Co. So it did the legal work for the Students Legal Service. But at the same time, we'd set up Caxton Street one night a week in 1976 before I went overseas. And it continued while I was away one night a week. Mm. And we'd been raising money and we decided to go full time in 1978. So I then opened Caxton Street as a branch office of NF Noonan & Co.
Oh, that's so interesting.
That got the insurance and the right to use the trust account so we could do legal work. And that's the way you had to do it in those days. And the Law Society told me to close down Caxton Street immediately.
Really? Why were they so worried about it?
Oh, I don't know, they opposed it at the time. So did Legal Aid. The Legal Aid Commission opposed it at the time because we had federal money that the Legal Aid Commission in Queensland was holding, but they wouldn't pass it on. I'm not too sure why they thought we were, you know, radicals, I suppose, that it was untested territory. And,
there were a few legal centres across the country, but was Caxton then the first Queensland community legal centre?
There was the Aboriginal Legal Service, Caxton was the first community legal centre here. There was like Redfern in Sydney and Fitzroy and Springvale in Melbourne. Melbourne had most of the community legal centres. It's always, as a state, has always been a bit more socially active than the other states. Queensland was a bit of a latecomer.
I'm going to ask you some questions. The first question that I wanted to ask you, weren't you just stressed as starting up at, you know, being probably the only solicitor, were you, at the Student Legal Centre and just being out of, you know, just being admitted? Was that a very stressful time for you?
No, it was pretty easy. Student problems are run-of-the-mill, sort of motor vehicle accidents, magistrates' court proceedings, the odd drug charge. We used to the odd demonstration charge. I used to do the leases for the students' union for the tenants out there. I drew them up for them. And we had student volunteers too, so we implemented that system. Peter Applegarth was one of our student volunteers. He's now on the Supreme Court and they're talking about him possibly being the next Chief Justice. I saw in the paper the other day.
And you can say, well, he was one of my students.
I taught him.
I taught him everything he knows about
and
being a student.
When I was an article clerk at Macrossan and Byrne, for the second year, my junior article clerk was Anne Lyons, who went on to become a Supreme Court judge as well, and she just retired recently.
Mm. Mm. So, well, they can all look to their mentor and all, you know. So when you went overseas, what were you doing? Just having a gap year?
Yeah, travelled around the world for a year.
It's a nice thing.
Oh, I actually went to a conference. I was one of the Australian representatives of non-governmental groups opposed to nuclear power at the time. I was an Australian representative with a Dr. Joe Camilleri in Salzburg.
Because of the Friends of the Earth connection.
I was in Friends of the Earth Australia, which was a sort of ratbag greenie group. And but in America, they were reasonably conservative conservationists. And so I went to America first and I connected up with them, and they looked after me, provided accommodation because I was going on to this conference in Salzburg. So it was a great connection to provide interesting people I spent time with, and they put me up, fed me and looked after me in America.
That's a great thing about connections, which I'm going to ask you about later, and mm-hmm. about how mm-hmm. you know, one connection can lead to another and give you really great opportunities. And particularly for young people, I think that's really a good thing to know about, about how you can do that.
To interrupt, my first job as an article clerk, I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but I had lined up articles with Shaka and Baker, and but towards the end of the year, they sent me a letter saying, due to the economic downturn, we can no longer offer you that position. So I was reasonably desperate in December. So I furiously applied for a few more firms. And I think it was the Catholic connection that got me the job at Macrossan and Byrne. It was an old Catholic firm in Brisbane that mainly looked after the AMP Society and did their mortgages. And
so it can become, the connections can be stuff that you never thought about would be really a good source of, you know, well, who would have thought being a Catholic would get you a job? Well, I mean, then again, I don't know about that. Being Catholic might have got you a job in a lot of places in those years. But I wanted to go back to Caxton Legal Service. What really prompted you to go and do that? Like, to be one of the founding members of that legal service?
Well, I was in the right position at the right time because I had volunteers working at Students Legal Service. When I came back in 1977, the end of 1977, there'd been that big march in about October, I think, where 400 people got arrested. So there was a lot of that work going on. A lot of them were students, and a lot of that work was going on through the Students Legal Service. So, like, we were organising barristers to defend people. I defended quite a few people. Then we wrote this booklet on how to defend yourself. The idea was we'd clog up the courts for having everyone pleading not guilty. But the magistracy appointed several clerks of the court, including the infamous Bill Mackay. And there were two magistrates up there every day hearing the demonstrator cases and generally finding them guilty. So we failed dismally by trying to clog the system.
I was going to ask you about when you started Caxton. I know you said about Legal Aid held some funding back from the Caxton Legal Centre early on. How did you actually secure that funding in the first place? Can you remember that far back?
It was an application to the Commonwealth Legal Aid Council, which was set up to distribute funding to, I think they only had $1 million, to community legal centres. So, and we'd obviously applied from Queensland, been successful, but it had to go through the State Commission for some reason. I'm not sure why.
But it still does.
Yeah.
Mm. Right. So... I think so anyway. Mm. So,
but we had funding from like Castlemaine Perkins and Mount Isa Mines contributed some money because the guy I set it up with, Lorenzo Boccabella, he was a journalist with The Age at the time. Mm. He'd done a law degree with us at University of Queensland, and he's a little bit younger than me, but he would front up to the annual general meeting of Mount Isa Mines and hit up the chairman for some funding for community legal centre that he's trying to set up. And so that's where we got our initial funding. So we opened up without the money from that the Legal Aid Commission was holding. Mm-hmm. And the Students Legal Service was paying for the insurance and the trust account. So our costs were pretty low. And we had free rent at the Caxton Street Hall at the time. So, yeah, it was, we were really doing it on the cheap, yeah.
Oh, well, that's fantastic, really. But you also started authoring the Caxton Street Law Handbook, and you did author a chapter in that. How important do you think that book has been over the years to practitioners, and why?
Right. Well, the first edition came out in 1983, and it was based on what they'd done down south. But we got a whole pile of lawyers involved, including people that are now Supreme Court judges, even retired Supreme Court judges, and academics. Paul O'Shea, who you've interviewed, was one. And I co-edited it with a lecturer from University of Queensland, so we got some university funding to help with typing and things like that. So I did a couple of chapters, and so it was self-published by us. And to start it off, we did two booklets, one called The Citizen and the Police, about civil liberties in Queensland, people's rights vis-a-vis the police. And Chris McKelvey wrote that, and then Tenancy Law in Queensland, which I wrote. So we published them, so we knew how to publish by then. So we then embarked on the legal resources book, and it turned out to be very successful. We got a lot of people involved. It gave us bona fides and established our credibility in the legal aid scene, like people at the commission, legal aid commission, the commissioners were very impressed with what we'd produced. So that gave Caxton credibility and helped with its funding.
And do you think, what do you think of it going online now? Because it's totally online published now.
Yeah, well, it's the modern way. Yeah. we had to do updates with where you'd have to pull pages out, take out pages, such and such, and put in such and such.
Yes.
So it's a lot more efficient to update it and have it online. You don't have to go through that whole process. But, like, publishing it was a pain because you'd get the typesetting done, then you'd have to check the typesetting and you'd find errors and you'd take it back. And in doing the fixing the errors, the typesetters would make more errors. So that was a laborious process. Then you had to run the typeset pages to the printer. So it was publishing quite a big and well, it was interesting. It wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. But yeah.
But it's a great thing. I've been an author in that book as well, and it's a really lovely thing to do anyway as a lawyer, to write for Caxton Street and to make it accessible to people, because that's the most important. It must be accessible so that people can actually enforce their own rights.
Yeah, people can go and research it, and well, there was no Google in those days, so but people can have a look at their problems. And the beauty of going to a community legal centre, you can get a second opinion on your case, whereas the average person that might be in the grip of litigation has only got one view of what's going on, and it's people with a vested interest in that you're paying them money. So it's one of the great things about community legal centres that you can go and get a second opinion about what's going on.
Well, certainly it means that, like you said, they're not going to have a vested interest, and a lot of the times they're just simply not going to take on the cases if they don't think that they have merit. So I always say to people, well, if people are asking you to put money up front, they're usually quite concerned about your chances of succeeding. So I would think very carefully about proceeding along that line. Obviously, Noel, it's really clear that you were involved in early on in activism using your law degree. Do you have any views on legal activism and how lawyers can practice in this area without getting on the wrong side of employers, or in the case of organisations funded by government? Now, I know that's a big question.
Mm.
especially in this climate?
Well, yeah, well, I couldn't really say in this day and age, but I think, well, a lot of law firms are reasonably tolerant about people being involved in community legal centres. They encourage it.
Yeah.
They've got their own pro bono schemes. You've got the Law Right, which used to be Q Pilch, where a lot of lawyers are involved in helping out, and retired lawyers, which is good. It gives people an opportunity to help people with Queensland Civil and Administrative Tribunal and various other areas that where they encounter the law.
So if your part-time gig doesn't come up, you've got a second career waiting back at you for you, the community legal centres.
I don't know whether I'll have time. I've got my garden. I try and lead a low-energy lifestyle. I ride a bike when I can. I play tennis on Mondays. I swim on Wednesday morning and then go to brunch. I swim on Saturday morning and go to brunch. I play table tennis about once a week these days. So my life's pretty full.
No time.
I don't know how I found time to be a magistrate.
Exactly. You left Caxton to go to the bar in 1985. What prompted that move? Like, you'd been very active as a lawyer, it would have been a completely different
Well, I was attracted by the court work. I enjoyed going to court, and I'd been largely responsible for publishing the legal resources book, and it had been a success, and I'd established lots of contact with solicitors through the legal service. So it made sense to go to the bar because even though I hadn't done any higher court work, like, I did my first jury trial in my first or second week at the bar, and I'd never seen a jury trial before, never sat through one, never instructed on one. I'd always operated in the magistrate's court, and I managed to win it too, a three-day jury trial.
And weren't you stressed?
I was stressed. No, I was sort of pretty gung-ho, you know, get in there and have a go. And then in the second week at the bar, I got another three-day jury trial. So that was highly unusual. That would not happen today because I was reasonably inexperienced. I made mistakes. I blundered my way through, I suppose.
Win the second one?
I did.
Well, that's a wonderful story.
I hit upon a tactic that I didn't know was a tactic, but a couple of the judges were old and crotchety, and they would get upset with you. You know, I remember the judge saying, "Mr. Noonan, don't you know anything about the rules of evidence?" You know, in front of the jury, I had a cutting from the Courier Mail where this police officer had been criticised before. And I'm showing him. And I said to the judge in front of the jury, "You mean I can't use this from the Courier? I can't even ask him about it?" And the judge says, "No." And, you know, that immediately won over the jury. You know, they thought he was an ogre. He was being very unfair. And I only later found out that barristers did that deliberately. They managed to upset the judge so the judge would alienate the jury. And the jury would feel sorry for them.
Oh, that's so funny. I just remember speaking to one of my other interviewees who said in his first year he got so stressed that he couldn't hear on the bar table what was going on in the court. He lost his hearing. And I'm thinking it would be just so traumatic to be standing there and not hear anybody talking to you. But good on you. But you then became a part-time magistrate in 1990. So you obviously had a successful 9 years at the bar, and you left to become a part-time magistrate in 1994. How did that come about?
No, that was full-time.
Full-time in 1994.
Yeah. Well, I knew that they were about to get a pay rise. I don't know how. I don't remember how I knew that. And I knew
all those connections
that they were opening it up to the private profession, because previously the magistracy had been the clerks of the court who'd come up through the system. So I put in an application. I don't know how I even knew that you could apply, but I applied, and I think on the strength of my community legal centre work and the fact that I'd been a barrister for so many years and was reasonably well known in the sort of lefty community, I suppose I got appointed by a Labor Attorney General.
Can I ask you about that? Because for a young person who looks at trying to become a magistrate at some stage, do you think working in a community legal centre or legal aid is still as important as it used to be? Because I do think there's been a lot of magistrates that have come from either the community legal centre or from legal aid or from prosecutions.
Yeah, well, it shows you've got a social conscience, I suppose, if you're involved in community legal centres and you're giving time freely to the community. I'll never forgive or forget one guy, one solicitor, who I know advised lawyers not to volunteer at Caxton Street. He went on to become a district court judge. And I'm sure he doesn't know that I know this, but he used to advise, because feedback got back to me, that he would tell people that asked his advice, he would say, it's not good for your career to be involved at community legal centres. But that was back then. I think these days the attitude's completely different, and I think most firms encourage their employed solicitors to be volunteers.
I think it gives you a completely different perspective. I remember speaking to somebody who interviewed at a private law firm, and they were told that if they were employed at that law firm, it would be 2 years before they got to speak to a client. And one of the things about working in a community legal centre, which I did too, that's where I started my career, is that you were thrown in the deep end. There was, which can be good, both positive and negative, but you certainly get very good exposure to clients very early on. And I think that's a great experience, and that's what being a lawyer is all about. And I think that's why a lot of people started looking at doing a law degree, because they wanted to have that that client experience and make a difference. Mm-hmm. So I think community legal centres are a great pathway or great vehicle for doing that. So, but what was it like then, that transition from barrister to magistrate?
The thing I had most trouble with was civil chambers, which was strange because by that stage I was primarily a civil barrister because I used to do my paperwork. There was one stage where I was offered a 3-week circuit with this particular, as a barrister, criminal circuit, with this particular obnoxious district court judge. And I thought, if I took that on, I wouldn't be doing my paperwork. And then if you don't do your paperwork, you don't get more paperwork, so you don't end up getting the civil. And the prospect of spending 3 weeks working with this particular judge on a circuit in a country town just didn't appeal to me. So I stayed, I turned it down. So I stayed doing my paperwork. So I always did crime. I always did family law, but I was predominantly a civil lawyer doing things like personal injury work, and ended up doing Trade Practices Act matters. And in the community legal set, I always had a base of civil as well as criminal, probably more civil with tenancy and all that. So yeah, I suppose I had a background through community legal centres in civil, but at the end my practice was predominantly civil, and they'd introduced statements of loss and damage so that in personal injuries actions, so that you often didn't get the brief for trial, because after you'd worked out what the prospects of success and their likely damages were for plaintiffs, the barristers or the solicitors could get together and settle the matter. Whereas before that, you didn't really sit down and work out all that until you got the brief for trial. And often the barristers would be able to knot out an agreement the day before, after finally someone had sat down, had a conference with the client, worked out what the amount they were likely to receive if they were successful was. You had, you know, Fox and Wood factors and Griffith and Kirkmeyer mm-hmm. factors and all these different things. So you'd then, more often than not, would be able to go up and see the judge on the morning of trial and say, "Oh, Your Honour, we've settled the matter. You know, you can relax.
And all that.
You can go yeah. and do something else now.
You know, go and have a drink.
Go and write that reserved decision or something." And then you'd go off to lunch with the solicitors and maybe the client. But with the statements of loss and damage, that you didn't get those briefs for trial and you didn't go to trial as much. So really, I suppose, one of the attractions of being a magistrate was that you'd be in court, whereas being a civil barrister, it's a lot of paperwork and you don't go to court that often.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Mm.
Having practiced predominantly in civil jurisdiction all my life. Mm. Do you think that when you became a magistrate, though, that people treated you differently? And what was the best... did they treat you differently because of your now more, greater position within the legal profession? Well,
I suppose you've got to be more careful in your personal life, and, like, you can't go getting speeding tickets and things like that. You've got to be careful who you mix with. You've got to set a good example. There's ethics that you have to abide by. And some people, of course, thought that I'd sold out by joining the system.
Anyone you want to tell me about?
No, they shall remain nameless.
Those radical greens or something like that. But as a magistrate, how do you think you've made a difference?
I had the law change there on the coroner's business. I was instrumental in one of the first people to work in the Murray courts, one of the first people to work in the drug court. I was one of the first outsiders appointed. So we tended to have a different perspective to the people that had come up through the system who arguably were closer to the police because they'd worked with the police nearby all their lives. And you'd go to some registries, like I remember getting really upset at Mossman because the police would be in the registry talking to the staff and giving them documents and things, but wandering around in the registry, whereas they shouldn't be there.
No.
The courts are separate from the police, and we have to be very careful to make it clear that we're not an auxiliary of the police force.
No.
Some of the older magistrates had difficulty. They saw themselves there as being there to support the police. Although having said that, the police have a very difficult job and often they need supporting. But you have to be careful and independent and be seen to be independent. Like you'd go to a place on circuit like Dejara and the court would be held in the back of the police station. That's just unacceptable. And it became an issue when you'd arrive in places like Pomperow, Lockhart River and that, you'd be picked up at the airport. Or Doomadgee was a prime example. Mm. You'd be picked up at the airport by the police. And so the local community would see the magistrate and his clerk being driven to the courthouse, which was right next to the police station, by the police. So, you know, it's a bad look. I used to try and if Sometimes the local Aboriginal legal aid had an officer with a car within the community, so I'd alternate between the police and them, and the legal aid person in town to do that, so that you didn't appear to be an agent of the police. And in Normanton, we used to stay, there were three hotels in town, and we used to stay at one, the Albion, which an old Aboriginal got up me in court one day and said, "We know you're down there at the Albion with the police," that it was seen to be the police hotel. So I changed, I moved. I couldn't talk my clerk into moving. He liked the Albion, but I said, I'm not, because of the perception of being too close to the police. And it was true. You'd sit down to have dinner at night, and you'd have to make sure you had your clerk and the legal aid lawyer and the probation officer there, because you'd find police sitting down beside you at the long benches to have their meals. And I'll never forget the first time I went to Cooktown. The prosecutor said, "Well, there's a barbecue on tonight down the back of the police station. Come on down to the barbecue." And I thought, "Oh, well, I didn't know any better." So I was going to go, but for some reason it was cancelled. And then the very next day, there was a trial, and the issue was identity, whether this particular Aboriginal person was driving this car. And I don't know whether you know, there's a common Aboriginal defence. It wasn't me, it was my brother. We all look the same. So identity is often a real issue.
Mm.
And three police hopped in the witness box, swore in the Bible and said, "Yeah, you know, that's him, that's who was driving."
Mm.
Now, if I had been down there having a barbecue and a beer with them the night before, your independence isn't preserved.
I think perception is a real issue in a lot of cases, and it's a very, well, particularly if you're working with them, like you said, if they're in the courthouse, it's very difficult also not to be influenced. Like, let's be fair, you do have an influence when you become familiar with someone. That's why in a lot of the cases when our clients are often in these proceedings, well, particularly in the area that I'm working in the civil jurisdiction, they've only have one experience with mediation or with a complaint or whatever, but the lenders will be there all the time, and of course they develop that relationship, and clients, people do see that, and they think, well, even if, and I think it's very difficult not to be influenced by that. I do think it's really a good idea to keep that distance. I know that you've made a lot of impact on the law in your role as a magistrate. How do you think lawyers can go about doing that?
Having an impact on the
society
law,
or
on society. Well, there's law reform commissions always calling for submissions. You can get involved and push for reforms. Mm. Look at the net zero emissions. It's coming about now, finally, the Conservative government, after the result of an awful lot of pressure, are finally moving. And it's often the case that politically, the reforms like that can only be done by the Conservative Party. But it's still a result of pressure. Pressure coming from lobbying, coming from submissions, inquiries, people making submissions to inquiries.
Mm. Is there a difference between serving in Brisbane and serving in a regional court like Mount Isa or Cairns?
Ooh, yeah, there's a big difference because you're reasonably isolated. Mount Isa, I was on the road. In a four-week period, you got 20 court days. I was on the road for 8 out of those 20. So I was often flying around on circuit or driving to Boulia, Djara, Cloncurry. So there's a lot of circuits. So you depended on your clerk. And Well, that's hard on some clerks who if they're female, they've often got children, so they can't go away on circuit. So there's a restriction on the number of people that you work with.
And can I just ask you about that? Because I think I would expect that you don't have the collegiate, the ability to talk to your colleagues in the afternoon, or, you know, to ask them, well, what do you think about this case? And is there a culture of doing that anyway, that you would go and say, this is the first time I've seen something like this. What do you think? But if you're a magistrate on your own in the bush and you're out there,
yeah,
you don't have any.
Well, in Mount Isa, I had the clerk of the court who'd done a law degree who used to act up when I was away. So I suppose I could bounce things off him, and you can always ring someone up. And in Cairns, there were four magistrates. And in Brisbane, morning tea is invaluable because you'll often, if you can discuss what's going on in the case before you or that with someone else or a couple of people, or say, well, you know, do you know anything about this prosecutor on that or this lawyer? it's very helpful to get a different perspective. So morning tea is often invaluable, I found.
In my research, it's become clear to me that what usually makes the news for magistrate courts matters is either the characteristics of the crime, the characteristics of the defendant. Suspect that there might have been a few defendants that quoted the Magna Carta to you or claimed royalty or some such,
mm-hmm.
or comments made or judgments passed by magistrates. So I'm first going to ask you about the Lindbergh matters, and if you could tell me a little bit about it, because I understand that that was something that was quite controversial as well.
Yeah, that was the Heiner Inquiry matter back in 1990, where under the previous National Party government, they set up an inquiry, but they didn't properly constitute it by setting it under the Commissions of Inquiry Act, and it was to look at the John Oxley Youth Centre, which incarcerated youths, children. So, and there were complaints about the manager of the centre, a Mr. Coyne, and he allegedly handcuffed someone to a tennis court. And there were other complaints. Anyway, staff complained, and the minister set up an inquiry, but she didn't set it up properly such that they had immunity. And the Goss government came into power, and the person, he was a retired magistrate, Noel Heiner, who was conducting the inquiry, said, well, you know, have I really got immunity here? Because Coyne went to a solicitor and he was threatening to go to the Supreme Court to close down the inquiry before he gave evidence, but he didn't do that. He then went and gave evidence, and then after he gave evidence, his lawyer was saying they were considering defamation proceedings. So the Goss government decided to close the inquiry down, and then they sent the documents off to the archivist, state archivist, and they collected all the documents in the Department of Family Services, sent them off to the state archivist and said, do you need these for any reason? The archivist said no, so they destroyed the documents, which was, in retrospect, a really silly decision. Mm. And I got involved in it through the CJC. I was a barrister at the time, and they used to contract me to come in on a day rate. They didn't pay me very well to look at old difficult files, basically, and advise what to do. So a set of fresh eyes looking at the way the CJC, as it then was, had conducted the matter. And I did this opinion, and I spoke to Linda Berg, who was the union representative looking after Mr. Coyne. I did a report saying that that the CJC had hadn't investigated it properly, that these were the issues, and I remember saying at the time to Linda Berg, I think, that if you got a choice between a stuff up or a cock up and a conspiracy, you take the cock up every time. And he somehow thought I was referring to the whole matter, the whole coin matter. But what I was referring to is what the CJC had done. You know, they had stuffed up the inquiry because it was complex. Linda Berg was an obsessive character who took every point and was incredibly diligent. And so the issue was, did the cabinet break the law, and should they be prosecuted for destroying evidence potentially required in a defamation proceedings? And really, it seems so far-fetched at the time that really I should have disqualified myself because Goss had been president of Caxton Legal Service at some stage. My accountant, or my ex-accountant, was the health minister in the cabinet, Ken Hayward. I had employed Molly Robson, who was the environment minister, to distribute the legal resources book before. So, you know, I knew and was friends with members of the cabinet. So in retrospect, I should have disqualified myself. But it seems, you know, I thought I was doing the right thing by Lindbergh and Coyne by pointing out that the CJC hadn't looked into it properly. And then I gave a legal opinion and said that I didn't think the cabinet was liable because A, there were no legal proceedings underway at the time, and B, and no one has ever commented on this, there's been half a dozen judicial inquiries and Senate inquiries into this issue for the destruction of documents, and it's taught to students, like any archivist students, anyone studying public administration, study this case. And clearly the cabinet shouldn't have destroyed the documents. They should have kept the documents.
It's just common sense.
Yeah, it's common sense.
It's common sense. Common sense. You don't need law.
That's right. Yeah. But was it, and there are people still around today who think the whole of cabinet should be prosecuted for destroying documents required for proceedings. But the other point I said was that, look, he'd already threatened to go to the Supreme Court to close it down, and he didn't. Now, this inquiry, although not set up under the Commissions of Inquiry Act, it was set up by a Minister of Family Services, Beres Nelson, I think it was at the time, and under the defamation law, anyone that came forward and gave evidence had qualified protection. So the reality is he never would, if he was properly advised, have taken defamation proceedings. So there was no real danger of that. So there was no real need to destroy the documents. Anyway, I gave a legal opinion, and I was criticised roundly through various Senate inquiries, and there's still material on, if you Google me, there'll still be material criticising me for being part of a conspiracy.
I think I read something about that, and I had never heard of it, of course, so yeah. I just said, I sort of felt for you a bit because we often get put into situations where particularly people who are not trained in the law often think that there is some conspiracy or someone did something wrong, and really there's nothing to it. But because the average person does not understand necessarily the legal system, thinks that there must be something going on.
Yeah. And also, a lot of people that looked at this were criminal lawyers. So they didn't have an appreciation of defamation, which is a reasonably specialised area. So a lot of people, including the DPP, ended up relying on my opinion. And my opinion turned out to be wrong, that you don't, look, I think it was a reasonable opinion at the time, but there was a subsequent case involving a pastor who had a diary from a sex abuse victim that chronicled the sex abuse in her diary, and he destroyed it. And that was before there was any criminal proceedings underway, and he was prosecuted successfully, although it never went on appeal, but he was found guilty in the district court of destroying evidence required for potential judicial proceedings. So, you know, that area of the law has been clarified, and I accept that my opinion at the time with respect to that was probably wrong, but I still say my opinion with respect to there were no real prospects that he would have gone ahead with defamation proceedings, and if he did, he would have lost because those people came forward and they had what's called qualified protection. So,
but you've also been criticised in another case, and that's a recent case of the Jacob Reichman case, where apparently you said there's a lot of incompetent solicitors running around the place giving legal advice, giving criminal legal advice. I see it daily. Did you really say that?
Well, yes, that was controversial because Reichman was he had a law degree. And he was acting as a solicitor, but he hadn't been admitted. So he wasn't really a solicitor, and he'd previously been convicted of it, acting as a solicitor, and he continued to do it during police interviews. He'd go along and tell police he was a solicitor and he'd advise people during the interview. And I found him guilty. He appealed. He was unsuccessful. And but in sentencing him, I said that he'd actually done a reasonable job representing those people. And I stupidly said that, sure, I come across incompetent lawyers regularly.
Well, that was
foolish. I should have reserved the decision and been more careful with my words.
Exactly. there must have been a certain level element of frustration with the legal skills of some practitioners appearing before you. So what makes a good criminal lawyer, and what skills could practitioners, particularly I think because a lot of the practitioners that are probably appearing before you in some of those cases might be quite young and inexperienced. So what could they hone to become more skillful?
Well, one of the things you have to not do is plead your client guilty and then say, but he really didn't mean to do it, like shoplifting. She was unaware, unconscious. And I heard a judge, I was an article clerk, he was the judge, he went on to become a judge, he was a junior barrister, but he pleaded guilty, a woman, to shoplifting in the old magistrate's court over at South Brisbane. I saw him do it, and the magistrate pointed out to him, well, you can't really plead guilty and then go on to say, but your client's not really guilty. And the magistrates get rapped over the knuckles regularly for not pointing out defences, or a solicitor will say it was all in self-defence or he was provoked. Then you've got to point out to them, well, you really can't plead guilty because it's not a justice system if you're not guilty and you're pleading guilty. So we're not allowed to accept that plea of guilt. But so many solicitors do it. And unless you have a detailed knowledge of the criminal law, you mightn't understand the law with respect to shoplifting or provocation or self-defence. And regularly solicitors will, one of the things I often say on sentences, well, what do you suggest? And you get the most surprising answers. You might be thinking of probation and the solicitor says, well, suspended sentence, Your Honour, or, you know, only send him to jail for 14 days or
something. So how do you think the profession can better support young practitioners to obtain those advocacy skills? Because obviously it is an advocacy skill, because you should be prepared to have that question thrown at you as to what do you think might be an appropriate sentence. And if you're acting for the defense, you don't want to be too lenient.
Sure.
Because, you know, so what?
Sure. Well, and then there are other solicitors that go the other way and they get a reputation for it in always asking for a good behaviour bond for their client and with no conviction recorded. So the law with no conviction recorded has been pretty stabilised now. There's a reasonably sympathetic High Court to that. So it's got to be a few offences, like on a first, certainly on a first offence, it'd be highly unusual to get a conviction recorded. And even on say, a third offence with over some period of time where it could affect their employment prospects and things like that you still don't record a conviction. So
had you been arrested now, it's likely that even if there was a charge and you appeared before a magistrate, you might get no conviction recorded.
Yeah.
It might still mess with your ability to become admitted.
I doubt it. Like, people have been admitted with history of selling heroin, for instance. They've reformed and proved it. Yeah.
Well, I think sometimes people with actual practical experience about what it is to be vulnerable in the community and then do reform make very good lawyers and can make very good magistrates
or judges. It's easy for people to make mistakes, particularly in their youth, when they mature they wouldn't make.
Mm.
The problem is we, as magistrates, you keep seeing the ones that keep making the same mistakes. The ones that, you know, go away, you don't see them anymore. The ones that, you know, they appear in court and learn their lesson and whatever, they're not the ones we see. We keep seeing the ones that come back regularly, keep doing the same things.
The what is it? The repeat offenders.
The recidivists.
Mm. I noticed on a Reddit thread that you once refused to return penis rings to an offender that he'd worn to work to enlarge his genitals. Is there any truth to this story?
I vaguely remember the case, but I think he was a kitchen installer who used to flash clients, the women that were in the house, while he was installing the kitchens. Yeah, and I can't remember the issues and why I didn't return his penis rings. He'd clearly been showing and flashing them to...
You wanted to prevent
females. Yes. Didn't want to go around showing his penis rings to more females.
There must have been some other unusual things that happened in your courtroom over the years. Is there anything else that you thought was quite notable?
There's a demonstration case recently with an Aboriginal guy who defended himself. And he did a very good job, and it was Black Lives Matter rally recently. Mm. An agreed march, and the police are very good these days. There's a system in place where they have to allow demonstrations and marches to go ahead unless the police come to court to challenge it beforehand. So they have a pretty good system of liaising with people that are holding demonstrations, and obviously our society goes through periods where there's demonstrations, and police now are pretty good with the right to march, but they'll put restrictions on it in certain area and issues arise. But Wayne Wharton, his name was, he'd led the Aboriginal demonstrators down to Parliament House, but they shut the gates. So they then kept going down towards the freeway entrance. And Wayne had the loudspeaker. And he was very articulate, and he knew the history. He knew about the Daniel Yock case. And he was taunting the police officers there by saying, like, I know you're all in the union and you all voted to support Chris Hurley over the Mulrunji Doomadgee case. And, I know about Daniel Yock, who was the Aboriginal guy who was taken into police custody and died in custody from Musgrave Park. And he said, one of his great lines was, this whole country is a crime scene, you know, they're talking about white-black relationships. Yeah. And, that's right, he claimed his daughter had been assaulted over at Musgrave Park. And, that issue, somehow he worked it in, but there was a great line, this whole country is a crime scene, he said. And then he was given a move-on direction and he was charged with disobeying it. But he was on the loudspeaker and the police couldn't, I found that the police couldn't establish that he'd heard it. He said he never heard any direction. Mm-hmm. And whilst the police had all sorts of cameras all over the place recording it, none of them actually recorded the direction that the sergeant gave him to move on, which was surprising. It was a big gap in their evidence. Anyway, I found I couldn't be satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that he was guilty of disobeying a lawful direction. I'd spent a lot of my youth and defending such charges when I was at Caxton and the Students' Legal Service.
That's a lovely story. Noel, I was going to ask you, seem to be a master of building relationships. So how did you build and maintain all those relationships? And what would be some advice to people starting off in their careers about how they can do that and do it effectively?
Well, just get involved, I suppose. Get out there. And I was highly motivated, particularly in my 20s, to change things, as a lot of people were. And we changed the family law, we changed the consumer law, we changed the right to march, the right to demonstrate. There were a lot of reforms that came about in the 70s as a result of us getting out there and demonstrating, making submissions, going to inquiries, networking in the sense of with community legal centres, and I was on the Council of Civil Liberties for executive for quite a few years in those days. And part of the community legal service role was to get involved in the local community. So I was on the Pijiu Terrace Community Association, and in the end I ended up running the whole functions we'd hold there. And there was a community jumble sale there once a week. And
So I mean, you've kept those, in a sense, you've kept those friendships all from those early years, really, as a solicitor and barrister in the 70s and early 80s. And they've probably helped you along the way in your later career.
Well, you're reasonably isolated as a magistrate. You're not really dependent on those contacts, or, oftentimes the people that you worked with might be appearing before you, and they're disappointed with your decision. So
exactly.
And you can't be seen to socialise with those people exclusively. So you're better off not socialising with them. The legal profession used to socialise at the Grosvenor, and when I was a junior magistrate, I remember going to the Grosvenor a few times on a Friday night. In retrospect, I wouldn't do that. I shouldn't have done that. The only sort of thing I regret was I once accepted a beer off a solicitor that I didn't reciprocate. That was Peter Shields, who's now on the parole board. That was the only time and the only memory I have where I think I could be accused of taking something that I
that might have influenced you. I'm sure that you would have been greatly influenced by a beer.
I regret accepting that beer.
Noel, anything else that you wanted to say to me before we close this interview?
No, I've covered the Lindeberg. I wanted to get that out, and the Lonigans. What else? The work I did up north on being on circuit all the time and going to those small Aboriginal communities. Mm-hmm. I did that for 6.5 years. In the end, I was burnt out dealing with Indigenous issues. One of the great things I had at Mount Isa was a thing called the Kalkadoon Aboriginal Sobriety House, which was run by Corrective Services Probation Service. It was sort of 10 miles out of town in Mount Isa, and you could send people there on an ICO. So Aboriginal people were often beneficiaries of being distant. It's often said that there's a lot of people in custody, but a lot of Aboriginals in custody. But one of the things that get sentenced as assault bodily harm, that in Brisbane would be unlawful wounding and much more serious assaults, end up getting dealt with as on a more lenient basis just because of the isolation. I suppose even police being lenient. But what I could offer to them in the community was, okay, well, I can send you to cash on an intensive correction order, which meant they could even take their family there if they wanted to. Mm. But they had to give up the grog and the ganja and while they were there. And I said, now, if you do, you know, walk into town, and they had to, if they wanted to get alcohol, they had to get to town, which they had to hitchhike or walk 10 miles to town to get it. And I said, if you do, you're then going to the big house in Townsville for the remainder of your intensive correctional order. So if you put them on like a 4-month intensive correctional order, and after 2 months they couldn't stand it anymore and they went into town and got drunk, they knew, and I explained it to them, that they'd then be going to the big house for their remaining 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And they all really liked that, you know. So, and they'd turn up with their toothbrushes ready to go to the big house because they realised they'd done the wrong thing, but they thought it was fair. But that was one of the great things, to have that as a sentencing alternative when I was in Mount Isa. Mm.
All right. Thank you, Noel. That was wonderful speaking to you. It was just so rich about what the life of a magistrate is like. If you want to find out more about Noel, there are show notes with each of my episodes, including contact details for each of my guests, on my website www.lorettacrete.com. Please drop me a line if you have any questions or know of someone who may be interested in being interviewed for this podcast. Thank you again, Noel.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.lorettacrete.com.